Are programmed the man who invented hobbits, J.R.R. Tolkien.
The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow if I can, pursuing it with weary until it joins some larger way, where many paths and errands meet, and whither then?
Aril berethkil toniel, sidivren penamiriel o menel aglar elenas, nachaired palandiriel o galavremmin enorath, fanuilos lelinathon, Nevaya, sin Nevayaron.
The voice of Professor J.R.R. Tolkien reading a poem that he wrote in Elvish, a language of his own invention. How did this learned Oxford professor come to turn his attention to such apparently carefree pursuits as making up languages? And how was it that this led him to write one of the most remarkable and successful stories ever put into print? John Ronald Reuel Tolkien was born on January the 3rd, 1892, in South Africa. And a good deal happened to him during the early years of his life. His daughter, Priscilla Tolkien, who lives and works in Oxford, takes up their story.
He talked a great deal about his memories of his early life, and many people may not be quite so familiar with the fact that, for example, he was in fact born in South Africa, in Bloemfontein. His parents were both English, but his father worked in a bank and became manager of a branch in Bloemfontein and was the eldest of a large family and, as was the custom in those days, was made responsible for the education and nurture of his younger brothers and sisters, with the result that he was only able to marry comparatively late. He did in fact marry a wife considerably younger than himself, who was one of three obviously very talented and apparently very beautiful sisters. My father's mother was called Mabel Suffield. She was, I think, the middle of three sisters. My father was always absolutely devoted to her and to her memory and talked very freely about her. He obviously believed that a great many of his talents, and therefore of all the family's talents, were derived from her, though he also talked with great respect of his father too. The story was a very sad one. He and his one and only younger brother, who was slightly under 2 years younger than himself, were both born in South Africa. His younger brother particularly was physically rather sickly, and the climate was apparently, in those days at any rate, thought to be unsuitable for young children. So as I understand it, his mother and father were advised medically that his mother had to come back to England with the two children, leaving his father temporarily on his own. He apparently, presumably then being left with no one to care for him domestically, got ill, contracted some kind of fever, and died within a remarkably short time of my father's mother returning to England with him and his brother. He did have one particularly poignant memory, which he often mentioned, which was that of his father painting initials on the trunk, which was part of the luggage, which was to bring them back to England. And he said he also sensed the deep emotion between his parents at their approaching parting. Perhaps they sensed that they were not to see each other again.
So Ronald Tolkien and his brother Hilary came to England, to the then unspoilt countryside near Birmingham, where they lived for some years. It was this countryside that made a deep impression on the boy who was later to write The Lord of the Rings. And here, as his daughter Priscilla Tolkien tells us, his unusual talents began to develop.
Evidently at a very early age, he showed his considerable talents, in which he was encouraged by his mother. She apparently, by the standards of that time, this is in the early years of the century, was a well-educated girl. She had worked as a governess before her marriage. She was interested in foreign languages. She had a beautiful handwriting. She was apparently talented at drawing and illustrating. He eventually got a scholarship to King Edward's School, Birmingham. He was terribly patriotic, and proud of his old school. He didn't show any of the sort of weak boy's bias towards book learning. He was terribly proud of the fact that he was in the college rugby team and obviously became one of the young bloods of the school. He was also extremely proud of the fact that he was a very bad boy at school in the sense that he neglected his Latin and Greek verses and was always making up other languages of his own, which he found far more interesting, and that he neglected the classics in favour of what was then regarded as very eccentric studies in Old English. He also, I believe, was already inventing Elvish at this stage of his life.
Inventing Elvish, creating a language out of his own imagination. It seems an extraordinary occupation for a teenage boy, even in the early 1900s. But this passion for playing about with linguistics absorbed Tolkien from his earliest days, and it was to lead directly to his other kind of inventing, inventing the great story of the Lord of the Rings. What use was a language if it had no history, no mythology, no story behind it? So Tolkien began, little by little, to invent the story of a different age of the world and a place he called Middle Earth. At first, as his friend Gervase Matthew explains, it was just for his own amusement.
It began as a private world when he was a boy. He told me once that he thought of it, he was thinking of it, when he was about 13. And I think there are so many reminiscences of childhood built up even in details of scenery.
Indeed, the scenery of the English Midlands around Birmingham was eventually to play an important part in Tolkien's writings. But meanwhile, in 1904, disturbing things had begun to happen in his real world.
His mother died, and he was left orphaned, but always felt that he was quite remarkably fortunate to have been put under the guardianship of a remarkable Roman Catholic priest at the Birmingham Oratory called Father Francis Morgan, who was half Spanish. This, I think, was the origin of his lifelong interest in Spanish as a language and in Spain as a country. It was during this period in Birmingham, when he was already an orphan, that he met my mother, then a young woman called Edith Bratt, who was herself orphaned, and they were put by their respective guardians into the same genteel but poverty-stricken lodging house in Edgbaston, Birmingham, where they conducted what I can only call a pure operatic love story, in that their relationship was strongly disapproved of by the authorities, so it had to be clandestine, but that they had an ally among the maid in the household, a wonderful character called Annie Gollins, who was clearly devoted to them both and gave them every assistance in developing their affair. In fact, what happened was apparently that my mother, who had the floor above my father and his brother's room, her heart was very much touched by the fact that they were perpetually hungry, as their landlady was both genteel and incompetent, so there was never enough to eat. And with the assistance of Annie Gollins in the kitchen, they invented a kind of pulley system, so that delicious bits of food were sent down to two hungry boys on the floor below, with my mother and Annie Gollins hauling ropes. This went on for many months until inevitably they were discovered, and they were forbidden to write or communicate. And my mother was banished to an uncle and aunt with whom she lived for another years. My father, in spite of this setback in his life, worked hard at his studies and achieved a scholarship to Oxford. He went up to Oxford, I understand, in the autumn of 1911 to Exeter College, Oxford, where he read, as I believe was customary for young men of his generation, first of all classics. He achieved a second-class degree in honor moderations, and then decided, which was much more unusual in those days, not to proceed to read a degree in greats, but to read English.
In the English school, he was entirely at home. Before he reached the university, he had already spent much of his time inventing at least one language of his own, and it was now that his fascination with and for words was able to blossom. Reading English gave him an opportunity to do openly and officially what he had already been doing constantly in his spare time, studying Old and Middle English, Old Norse, and the many related languages of the Northern Hemisphere. He seems to have been predestined for studies of this kind, with a name like Tolkien. In fact, it's German in origin. The family came over to England in the 18th century, and the name actually means foolhardy or rash. But at this point in his career, Tolkien took a decision that was anything but foolhardy.
The First War, of course, broke out in August 1914, when he was completing his third year. He achieved a great deal of disapproval among his relatives by deciding to stay on for his fourth year at Oxford, which was needed in order to achieve his degree in English. He took the view that if he survived the war, and as he hoped to get married, he would be very much more used to the world if he came back qualified. And so whereas so many of his friends volunteered in 1914 and were very swiftly killed on the battlefields in France, he worked very hard for a fourth year and joined the army as a volunteer in 1915 and spent the following 2 years mostly in France. He fought in the Battle of the Somme. He married my mother in March 1916. I think he probably survived the war. He was fortunate in that he developed what in those days, I understand, was called trench fever. So he was sent home as a sick man on the ship the Lusitania, which was being used as a hospital ship. And I think I'm right in saying that it carried a Red Cross and was known to be used as a hospital ship, but that on the voyage following that on which my father was on the ship, it was in fact torpedoed by the Germans and sunk with incredible loss of life, I believe in 1917, which therefore, as well as being a great tragedy, one felt hit one rather nearly, as it so easily could have been the voyage in which my father was a patient. He then spent some time in hospital, and eventually, in 1919, he and my mother, now married for 2 or 3 years, and all with one child already, came back to live in Oxford.
He soon settled into Oxford academic life. His first-class degree in English made him a natural candidate to work on the Oxford English Dictionary, which he did for some time under Sir James Murray. He also began to do some teaching and to make firm and lifelong friends. Among them, Professor Neville Coghill, then an undergraduate at Exeter College.
He was senior to me, having taken his degree already. And I was then only a demobilized second lieutenant, and I think he was a demobilized captain. I'm not sure about his rank. But at least I was the secretary of the college essay club, and I was deputed to invite him to read us a paper, because we knew that he was very distinguished as a philologist, and asked him to write a paper for us to deliver to the essay club. So I went up to him one morning, not having been introduced to him before, and I said, "Oh, Captain Tolkien, would you be so kind as to read a paper to us for the essay club?" And he said in his abrupt and very quick-spoken manner, "Yes, certainly." It was extraordinarily difficult to hear what he said sometimes, because he spoke so rapidly and without biting off his words at the end. And so I said, "Well, what will be the title of your essay?" And he said hastily, "The Fall of Gondolin." I said, "I beg your pardon?" He said, "The Fall of Gondolin." So I said, "The Fall of Gondolin, yes, that's right." So I wrote it down, never having heard of Gondolin, you see. And I spent about a week then trying to swat up in Bodley what Gondolin was, but there was no mention of it anywhere, you see. And it is, in fact, the name of the unfinished book that he has left, or it's just a part of it. It was rather like one of those William Morris romances, you know. And it was already full of philology, and how the inhabitants of Gondolin, which turned out to be a town, had 7 different names, and they were called Gondothlim, and I can't remember what the others were. But anyhow, they were part of the whole Hobbit and Shire and entourage. And I think I shall recognize it when it is published, as I hope it will be.
So already, by 1919, at least part of Tolkien's own great mythology had been written down. All sorts of influences had combined to create it: his childhood in South Africa and Warwickshire, his invented languages, and not least the horrors of the First World War, in which ordinary private persons were thrown into combat with vast forces which they didn't fully understand. Out of all this, in Tolkien's mind, there began to grow the story of Middle-earth, that other age of the world, with its demigods, the Eldar and the Valar, and its mortals and half-mortals, elves and dwarfs, men and hobbits. So the seeds of Tolkien's book were sown, though it was going to be many years before the books appeared in print. But it seems that in the 1920s he was already starting to write, influenced, as I've said, by the experiences he had undergone during the First War. Professor Neville Coghill.
I asked Ronald Tolkien how it was that he came to invent this whole complex, this continent of languages and peoples. And he said, well, I first got interested in the Shire and the Hobbit as a picture of the kind of nice, simple, modest Englishman that he just had been working with in the army. You see, the simple, common, ordinary soldier and bloke like ourselves, you see.
The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow if I can, pursuing it with weary feet, until it joins some larger way, where many paths and errands meet, and whither then.
From 1920 to 1925, J.R.R. Tolkien was working at Leeds University, first as reader in English and then as professor of English language. So he achieved his first professorship when he was only just 30, an indication of the respect his work was getting. In 1925, he came back to Oxford as Rawlinson and Bosworth Professor of Anglo-Saxon. Among Professor Tolkien's pupils at this time was Miss Elaine Griffiths, now fellow and tutor in English at St. Anne's College.
I was a devoted, hard-working, simple-minded undergraduate. And I went to his lectures, and contrary to popular opinion as expressed in some of his obituaries, he was really in many ways an appalling lecturer. When he came to the main point, he turned round and addressed the blackboard.
Professor Tolkien has been described as the best and worst talker in Oxford. Worst because he spoke so fast and indistinctly, and best for his wisdom, learning, and wit. During the 1920s and 30s, there were many who gathered to listen to him, and in some cases to have their own say. In particular, one group must be mentioned, an informal gathering called the Coalbiters. Professor Neville Coghill explains.
Coalbitar is the Icelandic word for people who sit round the fire during the winter and bite the coal, so as they get as close as possible to the warmth, you see. And so we joined together and met once a week and sat round the fire in the winter, each having a passage from one of the sagas to translate for the others, you see. I was allowed to do a paragraph. Professor Dawkins, who had a little experience of this sort of thing, he was allowed to do a page, and Tolkien did 20 pages. But that was how it started, a sort of informal group of people like Professor George Gordon, Tolkien and Dawkins, and I think Hugo Dyson may have been a member of that too. Anyhow, he certainly was of the Inklings, which grew out of it and used to meet generally in C.S. Lewis's room, at least as far as I remember. And we used to read each other our own compositions. And Charles Williams was a leading spirit, author of the marvellous book, The Place of a Lion.
Charles Williams, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien. Each was to become famous as a writer of strange, mysterious and supernatural stories. And each, at this time, seems to have come under the other's influence. Meanwhile, away from the sagas and the texts, Tolkien was occupied at home, telling stories to his own children, John, Michael, Christopher, and Priscilla. Their house in Northmore Road was the setting for original and remarkable bedtime tales, as Priscilla recalls.
Yes, I think one of the things I particularly remember when I was a little girl was my father's immense talent as a storyteller. He was a particularly loving and attentive father, and being an academic, one was very lucky as a child because he was always there at bedtime, and his workplace was at home. He had a study in the house. Therefore, unlike many children who, I believe, often see their fathers only at weekends, one saw him every night, and there was a long ritual of storytelling. I can particularly remember one story, which was the story of Rapunzel or Rapunzel with her long hair. And he used to tell these stories in the darkened room, and one often went to sleep before one remembered him going out of the room. I think probably my father's ability as a story writer generally overshadowed when I was a small girl my feeling that he was himself a writer of his own stories. Because I was in fact very young when The Hobbit was published. And although it is worldwide publicity that he wrote The Hobbit and read it aloud to the children, this is something of a myth. I think he may have read some of it to my older brothers, but he certainly did not to me as far as I can remember.
How did The Hobbit come into being? It's a story set in a land called Middle-earth, peopled by dwarves, elves, goblins, men, and small creatures with furry feet called hobbits. As he wrote the story, Tolkien was in fact adapting for children some of the ideas which he had been working on for years. The idea of a great continent at another age of the world, a continent with its own set of languages, which he himself had invented, or, as he would have put it, discovered. So The Hobbit was written, and then got put away in a drawer to be shown sometimes to friends. It might never have been published had it not been for the influence of these friends. Among them, Elaine Griffiths, then recently graduated and now a fellow of St. Anne's.
When I was a young graduate, Professor Tolkien lent me his, not manuscript, but beautifully typed copy of The Hobbit. He had a fascinating typewriter with an italic script. And I thought it was wonderful and read it with enormous pleasure. And quite a time afterwards, somebody I'd known when she was an undergraduate who was working for Allen and Unwin came to me and wanted something, I'd forgotten what, and I said, oh, Susan, I don't know it or can't get it, but I'll tell you something. Go along to Professor Tolkien and see if you can get out of him a work called The Hobbit. Because I think it's frightfully good. Now, she was a very attractive young woman. Not only was she good to look at, but she had a delightful voice, and I thought, now, if anyone can get this out of Tolkien, it'll be Susan. So off she went to see him, and sure enough, she got The Hobbit, and The Hobbit was taken and was published.
That it was published was due to Rainer Unwin, now at the head of the publishing firm George Allen and Unwin. In 1935, he was aged 10, the son of Sir Stanley Unwin, who then managed the firm.
I normally read children's books that were submitted to this publishing firm. My father used to pay me 1 shilling for my reports, and that was the fee I got when I reported on The Hobbit. It wasn't a very good report, actually. I read it the other day and was rather ashamed, but it was just good enough to not only get me my fee, but get the book published, and that was the important thing.
And so this brilliant Oxford scholar had a children's book in print. And scarcely was it in print before he was at work on the sequel, The Lord of the Rings. In an interview recorded in 1964, he explained how he continued the story of the Hobbits and Middle-earth into this second, large-scale work.
Naturally, I was pressed for a sequel. I looked for the only point in it that showed signs of development. I thought we'd choose the ring as the key to the next story. That's the mere germ, of course. Yeah? Then when I saw, of course, that if you're going to make a... I wanted to make a big story, I felt got to be the ring. No, it's not a magic ring. I invented that little rhyme. I'm in my bath one day.
That little rhyme, which you can find at the front of The Lord of the Rings, ends like this. One ring to rule them all. One ring to find them. One ring to bring them all. And in the darkness bind them, in the land of Mordor, where the shadows lie. The book, which is so long it divides into 3 parts, tells how the hobbit, Frodo, has to carry this great and magic ring on a dangerous and often terrifying journey to a strange conclusion. Writing this story required a tremendous amount of learning and invention, but then Tolkien already had a whole mythology to draw his ideas from, a mythology he had invented during his adolescence, a mythology which had its own languages. Lord Halsbury, who came to know Professor Tolkien later in his life, told me that in many ways Tolkien lived his story.
And he always treated these imaginative works of his as discoveries rather than inventions. The Red Book of Westmarch was a sort of reality to him, you know. And the innumerable artificial languages that he had discovered in the course of his researches would have been the way he'd have thought of it, you see. Are themselves linguistic efforts of a very high order indeed.
The Lord of the Rings was being written during the late 1930s and early 1940s at the Tolkien home, number 20, Northmore Road, Oxford. Professor Tolkien's daughter, Priscilla, saw the work in its early stages.
Rather strangely, because I was in adult life to earn my living as a secretary for several years and learnt to type tolerably well. I first started to type in practice, though without being at all experienced, when I was about 14 and was a pupil at the Oxford High School. With great pride, I used to type on two fingers some of the early chapters of what were to become the Lord of the Rings, with the result that I've always felt I knew chapters 1, 2, and 3 much better than the rest. I think every single chapter in the book, in fact, was rewritten, so none of those early manuscripts will have seen the light of day as they were originally written. As a matter of interest, too, I do know that he sent chapters as he wrote them to my brother Christopher between 1944 and 1945, who was then training to be a pilot, was in the RAF but attached temporarily to the South African Air Force in South Africa. And I believe as he wrote them, he sent chapters to Christopher, who then wrote back with his comments. So I would imagine at this time that my brother Christopher was probably much the most important literary critic.
But another young man played as important a part in the work, Rainer Unwin, son of Sir Stanley Unwin, the publisher. George Allen and Unwin had accepted The Hobbit for publication on young Rainer's recommendation. Now he had grown up, and during the 1940s, he arrived at Oxford as an undergraduate, very anxious to meet Professor Tolkien.
So I went to call and had tea. Very nice it was, very homely. And he used to keep bringing out of cupboards or filing cabinets or desk tidies sheaves of manuscript, and he would occasionally thrust bits into my hand and say, take this away and have a look at it, take it away and read it, and tell me what you think about it. Of course, he didn't really want to know what I thought about it, because he didn't bother to stop to listen. And anyway, I couldn't understand it, because it was the middle of The Lord of the Rings, not the beginning or the end or anything like that. It was just a sheaf out of the middle of it. And as I only had read The Hobbit, it didn't help much. He assumed I knew everything about it and could discourse in great detail about the cosmogony of Middle Earth. I couldn't. So I used to bring it back and have tea again and say, yes, that was awfully interesting. Well, I went off and went sailing during the war for a bit, and while I was away, I gather, though I wasn't there at the time, that Professor Tolkien submitted the entire incohate manuscript of The Lord of the Rings in one huge packing case, I suppose, to this publishing firm, then very short of paper, and without much by way of helping us, saying that it had got to be published all or nothing. That was the great stipulation at the time. No abridgments, nothing like that. It's all in, and publish and be damned. So it was read by one of our staff readers who reported that it was too Celtic, so it was rejected. And The Lord of the Rings went back to Oxford, where it was stuffed away in those capacious box files that he kept. And there it stayed. I came back having won the war and became a publisher eventually after having gone through Oxford and seen more bits of the manuscript from Tolkien. And gradually I pieced together, because he was very reticent about things like rejection slips, I pieced together the fact that he had in fact been rejected. So when I became a proper publisher, one of the first things I did was rush back to Oxford and say, now can I really see it, this Lord of the Rings thing which you've been talking about? So I got the manuscript again. And at that time my father was in Japan, and he was of course the proper publisher. I was just junior boy. And I read The Lord of the Rings. I thought it was a very great book indeed, and I thought that it wouldn't sell. In one respect I was quite right, and in the other respect I was quite wrong. However, I wrote to my father in Japan, this is fascinating, and said, I think we have a work of genius, and I think we'll lose £1,000. Can we publish it? And my father, with that true wisdom that comes from distance and great acuteness, wrote back and said, if, underlining it three times, you think this is a work of genius, then, underlining it three times, you may lose £1,000. And if you work that out, it comes right for him both ways. The only contribution I made to that publishing event was that I caused it, like Gaul, to be cut into three parts, and each part given a separate title and published at intervals. That he agreed to, because it was indeed a commitment to the whole, which is what he cared about, and it wasn't cutting it. He never did like the word trilogy. He never would admit that it was a trilogy. It isn't. It is one book. But it happens for convenience often to be published in three parts.
Rainer Unwin thought the book was a work of genius, but didn't think it would sell. Accordingly, he arranged at first for only a limited number of copies to be printed.
The first print number was 3,500 of Vol 1, 3,250 of Vol 2, and 3,000 of Vol 3, on the assumption that one was going to have a declining demand for later volumes. The assumption was quite a good one, actually, for most books. Of course, even before we published the third volume, the print numbers had gone out of the window. They just weren't realistic.
The Lord of the Rings was going, eventually, to achieve fantastic sales figures. But it took time to build up a following. There was, of course, a certain amount of interest in Oxford, where J.R.R. Tolkien was now Merton Professor of English Language and Literature. Amongst those who read The Lord of the Rings with enthusiasm was Professor Neville Coghill.
I remember asking him if any of his, if he'd got his material for any of the characters from people that I knew. And I said, well, who, for instance, are you? Are you Frodo? He said, certainly not. I'm Bilbo. That is Bilbo the historian. I'm just telling the story and keen to get it accurate and wide-reaching and complete, you see. But, of course, C.S. Lewis, he's an Ent. You remember the Ents, the tree people that used to talk like this. And that was also the way that Tolkien pretended Lewis used to talk, you see.
The book's early success depended partly on its dust jacket. Rainer Unwin explains.
We did manage to get three stalwart pieces of backing, which we used as a blurb, because I funked writing a blurb for The Lord of the Rings. I couldn't think how to do it. You either sort of use all your superlatives and get sort of sneered at, or else you tell the story and underpitch it. And that seems wrong too. So in the end, we got the three stalwarts, C.S. Lewis, Richard Hughes, Naomi Mitchison, to write pieces on the proofs. Of course, Lewis had heard The Lord of the Rings in part anyway, and discussed it with Professor Tolkien during the course of composition. They were very close. They were inklings. Lewis was marvellous. He cheated as well, because he not only wrote the part of the blurb, but he reviewed the book as well. And I'm sure one shouldn't review one's friends quite so ostentatiously as Lewis did. But it was a good review. I think it was in Time and Tide. And it was reviewed. In those days, books got reviewed, you know. There was more space for book reviews. I think nowadays, even, you know, 20 years later, it would have a much tougher time to get the space. But it had reviews, not all complimentary, some were. The worst, I think, was, or the funniest perhaps, was The Tablet, describing it as small talk and muddle. At that time, under American copyright law, they hadn't signed the Universal Copyright Convention. If you imported more than 1,500 copies into the United States without manufacturing, then you lost copyright. And this was to protect the infant American printing industry, a slightly out-of-date conception at that time. So, because nobody in their senses thought that this large three-volume work, which was, you know, selling modestly in a few hundreds, and they wanted a few more hundreds to just keep it going, they imported more copies from us. And almost, I suppose, without noticing, lost copyright. They didn't want to manufacture at that time. So that is how the loss of copyright occurred, which was later to have disastrous effects. Or, if you like to put a historical perspective onto it, it may be, one should say, it was the catalyst that caused the subsequent bombshell of a cult explosion in America.
For one effect of all the publicity about his case was to bring Professor Tolkien's name before the eyes of American students. So the campus cult began and gathered pace during the mid-1960s. The book seemed to have its own and separate appeal to the dropout generation. And, ironically, this enthusiasm spread back across the Atlantic to England, where the sales increased. By 1966, The Lord of the Rings had already been reprinted at least 16 times, and soon the American paperback edition had sold more than 1 million copies. Meantime, Professor Tolkien wasn't made any happier by all this. The negotiations over the American copyright had exhausted him, his wife was often ill, he had retired and was in his early 70s, living at Sandfield Road in Headington. It was at this point that Joy Hill came to help him. She was working for his London publishers, Allen and Unwin.
I was sent to see him in Oxford, and the prospect of going to see him was terrifying. The day I joined Allen and Unwin, I was put in an office with a girl who was besotted with J.R.R. Tolkien, his books, and pictures of hobbits she'd drawn decorated the walls. And from that first day, every day, Tolkien came up in some form, and everybody kept saying, "You must read the books," and I never did. So here I was, off to Oxford one autumn day, never having read the books. I went to the house, Mrs. Tolkien opened the door, and she was very amused because I was carrying a lot of parcels which contained gifts from fans, and we had great fun when the professor joined us opening these. Then I had to go to see the professor by himself, and after a few minutes he said, "Have you read my books?" The dreaded question. So there was a terrible pause, and I said, "No." "Why not?" came the reply. So I thought, well, I've got to be honest with him. I said, "Well, quite honestly, since the day I've stepped into Allen and Unwin, I've heard the name of Tolkien so often, and it's been thrust at me so often, and how marvellous the books were, that I've taken a reactionary view, and I've never read them." And then there was a chuckle, and he said, "Quite right, too. I'm very glad you've been honest with me." And after that, the ice was broken.
Joy Hill. Meanwhile, the fan letters poured in at the rate of about 200 a week. And being famous was by no means to Ronald Tolkien's taste, as Rainer Unwin recalls.
Fame puzzled him because he came so late, really, this type of fame. Academic fame, of course. Greatest academic reputation that any man has ever made on such a very small production of actual material published. It was almost a legendary, a word-of-mouth fame, because he never published much in his lifetime on his subject. This is one of the confusing things. You know, the great essay on Beowulf, the Monster and the Critics, which is still a sort of a seminal thing for the understanding of Beowulf, you know, is an essay. And we come back and back to that. So that when fame actually hit him in the form of, well, all the phenomena of bobbysoxing, he was puzzled and didn't like it very much. I don't think anybody would, really. I mean, he used to be woken up at 2 in the morning, when you're getting on in years, from on the transatlantic phone, presumably by a phone freak, I shouldn't get paid, asked foolish questions because the time lag hadn't been realised. When your rose garden is trodden on by tourists who come in to take photographs through your own window when you're eating breakfast, and this sort of thing, it was worrying, and it didn't seem orderly or decent, or the conduct that one would expect in a scoured shire. He was a little bit fed up with the foolishness of many inquiries that he received, and he tried in a way to protect himself from it. We sheltered him a bit at his request by taking a lot of the mail and doing some form answering, but that didn't prove terribly satisfactory for him because it cut him off from life.
Joy Hill.
It was part of my job to have his mail and, where necessary, give him the letters, which were personal. And indeed, he saw a lot of the fan mail, but he obviously couldn't answer them all because sometimes we average between 200 or 300 a week. What was so striking was that his interest in the various letters that came. Now, these were very diverse. Royalty wrote, presidents' daughters, prisoners in jail, people in Broadmoor, mothers with sons on drugs, social workers who had no life outside their work and were being depressed by their work. And he took a great interest in the underdog. And this is particularly so with one person who was in an institution and was having nightmares as a result of reading Lord of the Rings. And I always, as a precaution, had to check up with the doctor or the ward sister in these cases, because sometimes you've got people who write to him and were so ill that the next day they would forget they'd ever written. But in this particular case, he wrote to the person in question and continued to do so, and she progressed and he explained to her that there was no need to be frightened and gave reasons why. And every Christmas, he kept saying, I've had a Christmas card from Miss X. And the same was true of a prisoner in jail, who, when his cell door was locked at night, just lived for reading The Lord of the Rings and losing himself in that book. And also true of a lady of 80 in a London basement flat who was going blind. Her one highlight of the day was when her neighbour came in and read her the next few pages of The Lord of the Rings.
The road goes ever on and on, down from the door where it began. Now far ahead the road has gone, and I must follow if I can, pursuing it with weary until it joins some larger way, where many paths and errands meet, and whither then.
In 1959, J.R.R. Tolkien retired from the Merton Professorship of English Language and Literature, and during the 1960s he was to be found living quietly in Sandfield Road, Headington. But his wife's health deteriorated. He himself became increasingly pestered by inquisitive enthusiasts of his book. And in the late 1960s, he and Mrs. Tolkien packed up and moved house to the south coast. This time, every attempt was made to keep his whereabouts a secret. His publishers, if pressed, would admit that he was living somewhere in Dorset. In fact, the Tolkiens were in Poole, in a modest house whose address was only known to the family and closest friends. Even the neighbours, the shopkeepers and the taxi drivers who took him about the place, knew only that he was somebody famous. In 1971, there came a major blow for Professor Tolkien, the death of his wife Edith. They had been married for 55 years and had known each other since childhood. Ronald Tolkien had belonged to the Catholic Church almost all his life, and now it was his faith which kept him going. Joy Hill.
He was obviously very distressed. Yes, I felt that he had this most tremendous faith, that it carried him along in a way which, if he hadn't had it, he would have absolutely broken down time and time again.
Obviously, Professor Tolkien could not continue to live by himself in Poole. Fortunately, Merton College, Oxford, of which he had been a member and where he had worked for so many years, were able to give him a set of rooms, and he came back to Oxford. There he took up residence in 21 Merton Street. Looking after him was a Merton College scout, Charlie Carr.
He'd got a system. I mean, it was breakfast at 9 o'clock in the morning, which I think only from about two occasions all the time that he was here, this never differed. It was always 9 o'clock. He was a very, as I say, a man with a great system. Even down to his taxi for church on Sunday, it was always at 10:20, and that was it. He was always ready for it. Just waiting, actually, dressed, waiting. And of course, this Sunday morning was to St. Anthony's Church at Headley Way, Headington. And after that, to the cemetery of Wolvercote, to his wife's grave. And then back home for lunch. Then I used to go up and see him most evenings, you see. And
talk to him?
Yes, especially in the mornings. Every morning, I mean, I got his breakfast, etc. And it was a case of going out to clear about half an hour afterwards, and it was always this 10 to 15 minutes talk every morning. Could be anything. Local news, national news, anything it was going. Most interesting man.
Professor Tolkien was not alone in Oxford. His daughter Priscilla lived near him, and his son Christopher was working in New College, where he was a fellow, and like his father, a distinguished philologist. And the professor's other sons, John and Michael, were often able to visit him. As Charlie Carr says, he always liked to have members of the family around him.
Yes, he was a great family man. But there were odd occasions that he even told me that he was a lonely man. And he really meant this, because I used to sort of try and pass this off, sort of thing, or say something out of the way to make him forget this, but he was a really lonely man.
Once again, Professor Tolkien's whereabouts were a secret, in theory at least. But he put his address and telephone number in the telephone book for everyone to see, and consequently was scarcely ever left undisturbed for long.
He's so tremendously popular, and people got to know where he lived at 21 Merton Street, and especially in the summer vacations, these American visitors, they seemed to know where he was. And they just routed him out.
Did he mind?
No, he didn't mind, but he used to say, well, I've got work to do, you know, and all these people, so many engagements, and apart from people ringing the bell and things like that, he didn't really mind, but he did sort of say, well, something's got to be done, I've got work to do, you know.
The work was on the Silmarillion, the sequel to The Lord of the Rings, containing much of the history of Middle-earth. It was never completed by Professor Tolkien, but Christopher, his son, now has the task of finishing it, and it's hoped it will eventually be published. Meanwhile, Professor Tolkien's life was far from dull. He made firm friends with Charlie Carr and his family, and he was always happy in their company. Joy Hill.
Last year, during the Wimbledon Tennis Championships, I had to ring up Professor Tolkien, as was frequently the case, and every time I rang him up, no reply. So two or three days got past, and I got really rather frantic, thinking, I wonder if he's ill, what's happened to him. So I tried again, and I said, I've been worried stiff about you, when he eventually answered the phone. Where have you been? And there was a great chuckle down the phone. I've had a marvellous week, he said. I've been downstairs watching the Wimbledon Tennis Championships. And, he said, the precision of this, that and the other, and who do you think's going to win? And he'd been downstairs with his scout, watching television.
So Professor Tolkien's life went on quite happily. It was far from dull. He dined out with friends and entertained them in Merton. And he was himself given a tremendous 80th birthday party soon after his return to Oxford. He kept in touch with many colleagues and former pupils, like Miss Elaine Griffiths, Fellow of St. Anne's.
The last time I met him was when I was voting for the Professor of Poetry, and so was he. And I said, Ronald, you still haven't been out to my cottage. And he said, well, you haven't asked me. I said, I've asked you frequently. He said, well, when should I come? So I said, well, now. And off we went, this at about 3:30 in the afternoon. And we arrived at my cottage at about 4:00. The intervening half hour, he told me in great detail why Ekwald was quite wrong in his etymology of Hinton, as in Hinton Waldrist. And I thought I must ask him about this, because I can't write it down now, and I shan't remember. And, of course, I never had the chance to ask him the details of the etymology of Hinton. But we got to the cottage, and I said, well, Ronald, what would you like to drink? Thinking tea or coffee. And he said, whiskey, my dear, whiskey. So I produced the whiskey, and he wandered out to the garden, and he came in holding a tiny little plant of a trefoil nature in his hand, and he said, I thought it was the so-and-so, 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 producing the botanical name, which I have forgotten. But don't worry, he said, it isn't that, it's a such and such, such and such. So it won't cover the whole of your lawn. This was not long, after all, before he died. And always I shall remember the exactitude of knowledge, whether it went from a text and the root, an obscure Indo-Germanic word, to the little trefoil that was in danger of overgrowing my garden.
Elaine Griffiths. Few people saw more of Professor Tolkien in his last years than Joy Hill, who came down from his London publishers to deal with letters and business. She remembers vividly the last time she saw him.
We used to have a routine when visiting him about doing the work first and getting it over and done with. And then it was talk. And this time, strangely, he flapped his hands and said, oh, no, no, we won't do any work just yet. Have a drink. So we had a drink. And then he said, we'll go for a walk. And we went for a very long walk. And it really was very long. And I kept saying, wouldn't you like to sit down? Because I was tired, he wasn't. And he said, oh, no, we were going to see all my favourite trees. And this we did. And we looked at all the names of all the trees in the botanical gardens. And we went down by the river and looked at the willows. And then we came back again and we did the trees all over again. And he said, you know, I really would like some pictures of these. So the idea was that I was to go back in September and take some pictures for him of the trees. But of course, this was never to happen.
Joy Hill. Professor Tolkien's daughter, Priscilla, lives and works in Oxford. And so she saw a great deal of her father when he was at 21 Merton Street. What is her final memory of him?
And I think particularly, of course, of the last time that I saw him up and well, which was in fact very near to the time of his death, only just over a week before, when I had not the remotest idea that this was going to be the last time we would have lunch together in Oxford. I had just come back from a holiday in Salzburg in Austria, and I had brought him things which I thought would please him, a bottle of Austrian liqueur and a box of Mozart Kugel chocolate sweets. I was delighted to find that he had had time to eat all the chocolates, but alas, had not time to drink the liqueur. However, I know that the gift pleased him very much.
One morning at the end of August last year, Professor Tolkien set out to stay with some friends in Bournemouth. Probably the last person to see him as he left Oxford was his scout at Merton Street, who'd been such a good friend to him, Charlie Carr.
He was so much on top of the world just at that time. In fact, when the car was waiting outside, I said, well, the car's here, sir, and he was ready, all ready, come out of his room. I think one of the last words I sort of said to him was, well, I hope you have a good time. How are you feeling, sir? He said, on top of the world. That was his last words to me before he went.
After a few days' stay in Bournemouth, he was taken ill with an ulcer. Pneumonia developed, and on Sunday, September the 2nd, 1973, the news came that John Ronald Roald Tolkien had died in hospital at the age of 81. He had written two world-famous books. He had also left a great deal of unfinished work. Lord Halsbury was shown some of the unpublished manuscripts, and here he lists the works which Professor Tolkien's son, Christopher, is hoping to complete and publish.
There's the Ainu Lindale, or Cosmogony, the Silmarillion, the Annals of Valinor, the Annals of Beleriand, and the Akalabith, or Downfall of Numenor. And I should think his son and literary executor, Mr. Christopher Tolkien's got a pretty big job on his hands editing all this.
How to assess Professor Tolkien's achievement? Well, first we must remember his distinction as a scholar in the English language. Elaine Griffiths, a former pupil and now a fellow of St. Anne's.
What I shall always believe the great achievement of Tolkien is that he made scholarship, profound scholarship, a really vivid and living thing.
And then from this came the inventive writings, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, the creation of a new mythology. Donald Swan.
Now, as I see, Professor Tolkien heard and read about all these North mythologies. He then set about instinctively providing the British with one of his own, which, having done so, it naturally crossed the Atlantic. There's no reason why it shouldn't. And before long, mythology was the thing people were hungering for. So I, when people talk about the connection with drugs and so on, it's no more than the hunger of all people for a less stressful existence at one dimension removed in a book as opposed to within life.
And what about the man himself? Professor Neville Coghill thinks Tolkien's Christianity was a key to his personality.
He is a most convinced and practicing Roman Catholic Christian. And that sticks out of every page of The Lord of the Rings, though Christ is never mentioned.
And his personality. For Lord Halsbury, one of Tolkien's most outstanding characteristics was his courtesy.
He wore courtesy like a sort of comfortable set of old country clothes, you know.
Perhaps the best description of J.R.R. Tolkien was provided by himself. It's read for us here by his publisher, Rainer Unwin.
He says, in a piece of paper, which I've got here, apropos some inquiry, I am in fact a hobbit in all but size. I like gardens, trees, unmechanized farmlands. I smoke a pipe and like good plain food, unrefrigerated, but detest French cooking. I like and even dare to wear in these dull days ornamental waistcoats. I'm fond of mushrooms out of a field. Have a very simple sense of humour, which even my appreciative critics find tiresome. I go to bed late and get up late when possible. That's, you see, very much him. I can almost hear him saying it. He's a grand person and a very natural person. He never became too grand do what he had always done in the way he had always done it.
So ends the story of J.R.R. Tolkien, Oxford scholar and author of one of the world's best-loved myths. How future generations will respond to his books is something only time can tell. Certainly, millions of people at the present time have derived from The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings enjoyment, comfort, inspiration, and perhaps a little hope for the future. And how would J.R.R. Tolkien want us to remember him? As a scholar, or as the inventor, or should we say discoverer, of Middle-earth? Dennis Gerow put this question to him in 1964.
Do you wish to be remembered chiefly by your writings on philology, on other matters, or by The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit?
I shouldn't say there's very much choice in if I remember at all. It'd be by The Lord of the Rings, I'd take it. I wouldn't mind the other being remembered, but I'm conscious that they're small and not very important. It wouldn't be rather like the case of Longfellow, wouldn't it? People remember Longfellow wrote Hiawatha and perhaps one or two other things. I forget he was a professor of modern languages.
Heard The Man Who Invented Hobbits, produced and narrated by Anne Bonzer. Funding for options is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.